All right, we're jumping into Hebrews 5 today. Hebrews 5, 6, and 7 are some of the greatest chapters, in my opinion, of the New Testament. They are so crucial to, I think, answering this question that we don't consider. And this is how I want to start the analogy this morning or get our feet wet. So not planned. I think for whatever reason, a lot of y'all think that I plan like the illustrations that like I planted some people in my life to like bring about these illustrations, but I did not plan for this. Last night we were at dinner. We left dinner and my dad was following us back to the house, and my little brother's car dies. Okay, so it dies. We don't know what's going on with it. He pulls over, and we start looking at the car. So anybody here, when your car dies, what is the first thing you do? You open up the hood. I don't know why we open up the hood. Because I open up the hood, and what do I see in this 2005 Honda Pilot? Just nonsense. Like, I can change my oil, and I can look at the dipstick, and I'm not talking about myself. And I can fill my wiper fluids. That's about it, all right? I know how to jump a battery, but that's what I see when I look at a hood. So we're trying to explain to the kids. The car is not something that we can fix. This is beyond our repair. It's beyond the guy's repair. So we have to take it to the car doctor. And that was the mistake I made, because all morning my kids have been asking me, now, what is a car doctor? So explain to me, what is a car doctor? Why do we take someone to the car doctor, or a car to the car doctor? Okay, why don't we just fix the car ourselves? We don't know how to do it. We don't know how to do it. And so you take it to this special place. You take it to a designated area where there are designated people wearing designated clothes that have gone through the training and the instruction on how to fix this problem, right? Because you know the problem is not something superficial. That is exactly what we need to be thinking about as we think of the priesthood. We are coming to Christ this morning in the study of Hebrews chapter 5, and we're not going to have time to study 6 and 7, but also chapter 10, because what we're trying to answer is, why the high priest? Why do we need a priest? And just think about that question in your own mind this morning. Do you know a priest? Have you ever met a priest? Have you met someone who is specifically designated to be holy, set apart, unique, one of a kind, for a specific purpose? And I hope that as I ask that question, you're not thinking of an individual who wears special garments. I hope you're thinking about yourself. I hope you're thinking about members of this congregation. And really, the question that we are trying to answer in answering why do we need a high priest is, there's a problem that we can't fix. There's something that is deeper than the superficial. We can change the fruit, but we need to change the tree, right? The fruit is not the problem. The tree is the problem. So that's really what we're trying to do. We're trying to change the tree. And the person who's going to be qualified to change the tree is not another human. That's why we need the high priest of Jesus. A human cannot fix another human's problems. A human cannot get into the deep root issue. And this is still true today. A preacher cannot fix a person. An eldership cannot fix a person. And sometimes I think we forget that simple lesson, and we put a lot of stock into people rather than putting it into the Lord, which is ultimately what's going to fix the problem. So we're going to read a few verses here in Hebrews chapter 5. Hebrews chapter 5. And I want someone who can read with some pizzazz this morning to read verses 1 through 6 of Hebrews chapter 5. Who wants to read for us this morning? The first 6 verses. All right, Mike, thank you. Yeah. Just read, man.
For every high priest chosen from among men is appointed to act on behalf of men in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. He can deal
Excellent, thank you. So chapters 3 and 4 of Hebrews are all about entering God's rest. And you have this call by the Hebrew author, don't miss out on rest, don't miss out on rest, don't miss out on rest. And so how do we not miss out on rest? Understanding the greatness of God's faithfulness, understanding that we need to come to God with some fear and reverence, understanding that a Christian life or a life of a priest, as you and I are today, without faith and growth is going to be ultimately purposeless, without purpose, because you're not living for God, you're really just living for yourself. So all that leads us up to Hebrews chapter 5 that starts talking about the high priest. And just in asking the question, who appoints the high priest and what are his responsibilities? So in reading the text, those things should have jumped out at you. But let's answer the first part. Who appoints the high priest? This is the softball, guys. We got to... God, thank you. So God appoints the high priest. I don't get to decide that I want to be a high priest today. I don't get to decide, you know what? I feel like I'm qualified, therefore I'm going to slot myself into that role. The high priest is chosen by God. And in fact, we have numerous examples of people desiring the priesthood, people wanting to be God's special people, and they want to usurp what God has designated or who God has designated or chosen. And God does not take that rebellion lightly. And so we see throughout the Bible that God is the one who appoints the high priest. And for those of us that have read and maybe studied this some more in the Old Testament, if you're a visitor and you don't understand this, that's fine. But where did the priesthood come from? What tribe? And specifically, if you were going to be a high priest, what family? So it came from the tribe of Levi, and again, all this is Old Testament. If you desire to study more about this, you want to learn more about this, I'm happy to teach it to you. It's super easy. You can learn the genealogies. But they come from this tribe of Levi. And just because I'm a Levite doesn't mean that I get to be a high priest. Just because I'm from the right tribe doesn't mean that I get to fulfill this role. I have to be a descendant of what man? Aaron. So God chooses the priest, and he chooses the priesthood and the high priest. And then what are they supposed to do? Well, we read, and you can look at the underlying passages here, they offer things pertaining to God, gifts and sacrifices for sins. They are obligated to offer sacrifices for sins. And then, again, this underline that they are called by God. So when we think of priests, we typically think of the sacrifice offerings for sin, not so much being a master of the law or someone who knew the law and was capable of teaching the law. That was also a responsibility of the priesthood. But here we see a glimpse of what the roles and the responsibilities are. Questions or comments through verse 1, or through question 1, sorry. Question 2. So someone tell me, based off that reading, and I gave you another reading to do here if you were able to do this beforehand, what's the difference between the priesthood of Jesus versus the Levitical priesthood? So Jesus was not from the tribe of Levi, right? He was a descendant of which tribe? Judah. So therefore, he is not qualified to enter into this priesthood. But, in fact, the Hebrew author describes to us that his priesthood doesn't come from the Levites. It comes from who? This guy named Melchizedek. Now, we don't have time again this morning to discuss who Melchizedek is, but that's okay. The point I want you to understand is God was qualified to choose the Levitical priesthood. God is also qualified to choose Jesus' priesthood coming from Melchizedek. And Melchizedek appears very briefly in the Old Testament. He's like a blip on the radar. And one of the things that you see in this Hebrews 7 passage is that the qualification for Melchizedek is that he's this priest king. He's this king of Salem, this king of peace. So he's this priest king that Abram, the patriarch of the Jews, offered sacrifices to. And Abram offered sacrifices to Melchizedek. And Jesus' qualification comes based off this man who had no genealogy. That's what the idea is behind he had no beginning or end. He had no mother or father. Why is a genealogy important? And why would the text ever mention that Melchizedek had no genealogy? Genealogies were crucial. Yes, Michael? No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, everything that a Jew's life revolved around genealogy.
Amen.
Where they lived, what land was theirs.
Yes.
What order they were traveling whenever they traveled in the wilderness. Everything revolved around it. And this is one that's completely outside of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Genealogies were vital to the life of a Jew. You needed to know who you were and where you came from. That's why we have passages like 1 Chronicles 6 that talk about just genealogy after genealogy. This person begat this person. This is the son of this person. Because genealogies were so important to their people and their society. And now you have God saying, look, this person of Melchizedek didn't have a genealogy, yet they were qualified to be a priest. And that's where Jesus comes from. Jesus is qualified to be a priest because he comes from the order of Melchizedek, and this priesthood is based not on genealogy, but on chapter 7, verse 16, the power of an indestructible life. He is qualified to be a priest because of his indestructible life. Questions or comments through question two? So I'm trying to really get us to see this is who God has presented as our high priest. This is who God has given to us to be our high priest. But now we answer the question, so what? What does it matter that I have a high priest? What does it matter that Jesus is my high priest? Why is that important? And to that, we're going to go to Hebrews chapter 10. So we're going to stay in the book of Hebrews, and we're going to flip over to Hebrews chapter 10. And we're going to start in verse 19. Verse 19 of Hebrews 10 starts with what word? Therefore. So therefore is a transition word. So everything that he said up until this point is so that he can make these next few points. Therefore, I want to tell you some things about what it means that Jesus is your priest. I want to tell you some things about what it means that Jesus is your sacrifice, that you were redeemed not with the blood of bulls and goats, not with the ashes of a heifer, but you were redeemed by the blood of Jesus, that you are part of this new and living covenant that God has established, not one that was based off the old promises, but on new promises. Therefore, so this is where we need to get excited, because we're about to try and understand what the book of Leviticus had to do with God's people then, what it has to do with us now, and how this is going to be relevant to you and I today. Why did we waste a quarter, and I'm choosing that word intentionally, waste a quarter studying Leviticus if it has no implications? Well, the point would be that it does have implications. And if we don't figure that out, then yeah, we just studied to study, and that's not good. There's no reason just to have knowledge. We need to understand what that knowledge is going to do for us today. So what's the proper response to God's priesthood? What's the proper response to God establishing a new covenant? Verse 19, therefore, brethren, since we have confidence to enter the holy place. Let's talk about that. Someone explain that to me. Why do we have confidence to enter the holy place? So there's a lack of confidence that's the implication, right? If I have confidence, then therefore at one point I shouldn't have had confidence. So I have confidence to enter the holy place. What's housed in the holy place? The presence of God. Who was allowed to enter into the presence of God on the Day of Atonement? Leviticus chapter 16, one day a year, sprinkling the blood on the altar. The high priest, right? So therefore, I have confidence. You have confidence. We have confidence to enter. Why? How did that happen? Like, that's a massive jump, right? At one point, you weren't supposed to come in because you didn't belong to the right tribe. You didn't belong to the right lineage. The genealogy didn't match up. You weren't supposed to come in. And in fact, it would be a terrifying thing to go into the presence of God. But now you have confidence. Why? How did that happen? And this is how I want to explain it. I'm not making a political statement. This is how I want to explain it. God saw a disease in us. He saw a disease, a sickness in us. And that disease led to death. That's what we were reading about in Leviticus. That death marked us as unclean. And because of our uncleanliness, whether that be from touching a dead body, whether that be going through the natural processes and cycle of life, it brought death into the camp. And therefore, I was unclean. So what did God do when he saw the disease, when he saw the sickness that was leading to death and bringing death into his presence and into the camp? He said, I'm going to give you the solution. I'm going to give you the vaccine. And I want you to take this vaccine and I want you to inject it into your body because I'm not trying to deal with the symptoms. I'm not trying to change the fruit. I'm trying to change the tree. And that symptom, the thing that God was trying to change was our heart. We had a bad heart. And that's why we spent time reading and studying passages in Jeremiah and Ezekiel and Isaiah that talked about what God was going to do with our heart, how he was going to change the hardened heart that we had had. And he was going to fix us with this vaccine. Now, therefore, because God has offered me the remedy, he has offered me the solution, he has fixed my life by making the vaccine available, I get to enter into his presence with confidence. Verse 20, by a new and living way, which he inaugurated for us through the veil. That is his flesh. The veil was the thing that was separating man from God, right? Now that veil is open. That veil is left open. And what do you do when something is open? You walk through it. You walk in it. You come into it. So the veil is open. Verse 21, and since we have a great priest over the house of God. So here it is. I want to explain this very quickly. This is what verses 19 through 21 are saying. We have a greater priest in Jesus. We have greater promises. And we read some of those blessings in chapter 26 and 27 of Leviticus, right? We have greater blessings, greater promises. We have a greater priesthood, chapter 7. In chapter 8, we have a greater covenant. In chapter 9, we have a greater sacrifice. So because everything that God has offered us is offered in Jesus, verse 22 says what? What does verse 22 start off with? Let us draw near. Guys, those two words are some of the most profound words that I've ever read in the Bible. And I didn't really understand how profound they were until we spent time reading Leviticus. Because, again, Leviticus is God's invitation to have his people draw near. Draw near. Come to me. I want you to be close to me. Why is that important? Because I think for a lot of us today, and maybe for some of you sitting here this morning, that's not your vision of God. You have a vision of God that looks something like this. Look, I know that God saved me, and I know that God loved me, and I know that God brought me to a place in my life where maybe we could kind of be cordial. But God doesn't want me to draw near. God doesn't want me really around him. Because he kind of looks at me with disgust and he's like, yeah, like I saved you, just don't touch me. Because you're gross. Your sin is disgusting. And I just see this mauled animal and this thing that's just stained and dirty. And so what happens with our mindset? Because we think that's how God is, we start applying that mindset to one another. And we start applying that mindset to the congregation, the church. And I'm not talking about the building. I'm talking about the congregation, the church. And we start thinking, you know what? God doesn't really want me close to him. And when I start sinning unintentionally, the people don't really want me close to them. So, you know what? I just better stop showing up. And then you start following this gradual process where you get further and further and further and further away from God. And if you've gotten further and further away from God, you've gotten further and further away from God's people. So this section is targeted to help us not have a faith that is diminishing, a faith that is wavering. This is the solution. Let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts, what's the word? Sprinkled, right? Do you see the Levitical language in here? Like, do you see what we've been studying? How the priest takes that blood and he sprinkles it on the altar and he sprinkles it on the people and he, like, you see the language, right? So we have our hearts sprinkled. And what's the sprinkling of the blood representative to the Jewish audience? That sounds dirty to us, but to them it was a what? It was a cleansing. I'm hearing the words. It was a cleansing. It was a washing. Is that not describing what we do in baptism? Not the sprinkling, but the washing, the cleansing ritual? That we're trying to take something that was defiled and make it pure and holy unto God. So we go through this ritual washing process, this ceremonial cleansing. We have our bodies washed with pure water. So verse 22, this is how I want to describe verse 22. Why do you need a high priest, or why is Jesus qualified to be your high priest? What does this have to do with anything? The first thing that you need to see in the text is that this requires personal engagement. You have a responsibility to respond to Jesus' priesthood. You need personal engagement. We are not saved collectively. You are not saved because you went to a church that has the right lettering across the marquee. You have a personal responsibility to engage in what Christ has done for us, what God has done for us. Verse 23, let us hold fast. What's the implication? It's easy to lose this, right? If I have to hold tightly to it, if I have to hold fast to it, it's easy to lose it. And then he says, let us hold fast the confession. So when we hear the word confession, we think of acknowledging or admitting wrongs, right? That's what most of us think. So this verse has tripped me up for a long time because that's how I understood confession. I didn't really get it. Well, the word confession here actually has another meaning. It means to acknowledge the truth. Specifically, confession here is acknowledging the truth of the gospel. That you proclaim truths about what God has done. So that changes things because I have a personal engagement in verse 22. And now in verse 23, I have the need to engage others. That I am holding fast the truths or the proclamations of the gospel of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful. We talked about that too, right? God's covenant promises, how he put Abram to sleep and he entered, he passed between the animals that were slaughtered so that covenant faithfulness could be established. So, I have a personal engagement in verse 22 and verse 23. I proclaim these truths. I announce them to others. Was that not the role of the priests? To share this knowledge that they had about God with others, with everyone. That they proclaim the excellencies of God. And we've spent some time looking at that citation in 1 Peter. that we proclaim the excellencies of God. So therefore, we get to question number three. Well, before I get to question three, questions or comments? Yes.
I think one of the most powerful verses in the Bible is in James 4.
Okay.
Where it says, resist the devil, he will flee from you. Draw near to God, he will draw near to you.
Amen.
And that fits in with what we're reading here.
Again, this concept of draw near. For any gentlemen in here that want to prepare a lesson, or you're coming up to prepare a lesson, do just a Google search or a Bible app search on those two words, draw near, and see how often they pop up. From the Old Testament, through the Psalms especially, the Psalms have a lot of association with this concept of drawing near. This concept of drawing near is so amazing, and it's so unique to us understanding that God does want us close to him. That Jesus, being our high priest, being the one who entered into the holy presence of God, invites us to enter into his holy presence as well. He made us perfect. This goes back to chapter 10, verse 1. For the law, since it only is a shadow of the good things to come and not the very form of things, can never, by the same sacrifices which they offer, continually, year by year, make perfect those who draw near. The law couldn't do that. Jesus did. Jesus can make us perfect. And I think that's significant because now I get to draw near. Michael?
Two things that stood out as...
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that of the person that made the sacrifice. And that's kind of the strange thing about this new way that he's telling
us. Amen.
The high priest is also the sacrifice.
Yeah.
So, but what stood out even more, the second thing, what stood out even more is the tenses of the verbs. He inaugurated past tense through his blood. But then he said, but since we have a high priest, not had a high priest.
Amen. Yeah. Yeah,
and these are the reasons why we can do good things, not because he sacrificed when he was dead, but he sacrificed when he was still alive.
There's no real way of proving this, but there's an estimated, and most people are in agreement with this, there was an estimated 70 high priests from the time of Aaron through the time that the priesthood ceased to be. 70 high priests. It's a lot. It's a lot of people. And again, you know, the high priest tended to be high priest into their 70s, and then they would retire and pass on the knowledge and the procedures to the following high priest. But 70, we have one. And we have one that continues to be our high priest. Like, I don't have to worry who the next high priest is. I continue to serve under this high priest that continues to offer sacrifices, not for his sins first, but just for mine. And that's an amazing thing. Other questions or comments up through verse 22? All right, question number three. Can verses 24 and 25 relate to our assembly outside of the church building? I try to choose my language very carefully here. This is how 24 and 25 are often taught. I don't think it's a wrong teaching. Just think it's an incomplete teaching. And let us consider how to stimulate one another to love and good deeds, not forsaking our own assembling together, as is the habit of some, but encouraging one another all the more as you see the day drawing near. So this is how verses 25, see, look, right there. That, you want to know why you got to come to church, Kyle? It's right there. Don't you miss the service. Like, it's right there. That's how verses 24 and 25 are often used. It's our go-to passage to say, this is why you got to be in the pews. That's not what it's saying. Or at least not entirely. I think you can make that point. Verses 24 and 25 are really saying, because I understand the greatness of this covenant and the greatness of my high priest, I draw near to God. And what does drawing near to God look like? It looks like drawing near to his people. And part of my responsibility in drawing near to his people is that I encourage and I stimulate and I provoke and I challenge one another to love and good deeds. Now, if you think that by you forsaking the assembly and sleeping in or going camping or going on a trip is stimulating me to love and good deeds, that's between you and God. I'm not going to tell you one way or another that was the incorrect choice. But I will say, when people don't show up, when my family is missing, that's not stimulating to me. And I'll tell you from my vantage point, that's not encouraging. I am not provoked to love and good deeds. And it's a simple analogy, and this is not what the lesson is about this morning, but I want to talk about it briefly. So many of us got to spend Thursday with our family members, right? Whether they were immediate, distant relatives, we got to spend time with family on Thursday. Thursday, I had dinner with my family. How would you act, I just picked Tommy. Tommy, so how would you act if, Macy just didn't show up?
I'd go get her.
Yeah. So you wouldn't just be like, maybe she was here in the morning and, she's good? Her. Yeah. I think many of us, if someone didn't show up to dinner for that night, we'd be like, man, that's kind of odd, right? I feel like they should have been here, but they weren't. Now, that takes us knowing our family. That takes us knowing who is supposed to be here, right? So we need to do a better job of getting to know our family. And I keep hearing, I've heard this a lot, we're a big group here. It's hard. It is hard. It is hard. Know your family. Just introduce. I introduce myself to everyone, and I ask, are you a member here? And I have a 50-50 shot, right? So ask. Find out who your family is. But here's the point, going back to this. Verses 24 and 25 are really trying to get us to say, when you come together, when you assemble together, it's supposed to be intentional. It's supposed to be purposeful. And this is why I ask this question. Is that limited to what we just do inside the building? And I don't think so. What do we do once a month, or maybe twice a month, depending on the month? We have neighborhood devotionals, right? We have group meetings. We have times where we get together with one another outside of the building. Some of us come together inside the building. That's okay. Doesn't really matter where you assemble. But here's the point. Those times where we're assembling together with God's people are not just to hang out with our friends. Now, that's good. You should hang out with your Christian friends. You should hang out with your church family and develop those relationships. That's awesome. That's great. Continue to do that. That's not really what this verse is talking about. It's talking about when you're coming together, you are stimulating and challenging one another. Why? Why do I have to do that? Because it's easy to not hold fast to the truths that you once accepted. It's easy to forget about it and let that go. I was talking to a young man last night, and he was mentioning, he's 26, and he was mentioning just how many friends he's already had at 26 that have lost their faith, that have forsaken their faith. And I said to him, unfortunately, that's going to keep happening. I'm 31. 31, and I've had friends just give up. Let it go. I have a friend here who I've known since college. And one of the greatest joys that I have is seeing their face. Because I'm like, man, you're still faithful. It is easy to slip away. It is easy to stop drawing near to God. It is easy to stop drawing near to his people. But because of the high priest we have, he says, let us consider how to stimulate one another, how to maintain the bonds that we have. Or as this say, we must prioritize our coming together because we're supposed to challenge one another. And we're supposed to challenge one another to do the thing that is very unnatural. So, question number 4. I asked you to go back and read some passages in Leviticus. What is the difference between the former passages and verse 25? Verse 26 says, for if we go on sinning willfully, that idea of sinning willfully is sinning with your fists raised. I'm going to defy God. I'm going to reject his vaccine. I'm going to reject the cure that he's offered me for a hard heart. I don't want God. I don't want Jesus. I don't need to do anything about this. Now, some of you are hearing that and you're saying, oh, so that doesn't apply to me. That's talking about the people that are in apostasy. No, this applies to you too, because you could very well be one of the people that start sinning defiantly and rejecting God. And so what happens? But a terrifying expectation of receiving the knowledge of truth, there is no longer remains a sacrifice for sin, but a terrifying expectation of judgment and the fury of fire which will consume the adversaries. That doesn't sound like good news. Verse 31, it is a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Judgment doesn't sound like good news. Judgment doesn't sound like something we ought to be excited for. And in fact, when you start reading that kind of language, you're like, that doesn't sound like a God who is loving and merciful. If you saw a group of fifth graders pounding a first grader, would the loving and merciful thing to do just to be like, ah, you know what, kids are kids. What are you going to do? Is that what God did in his love and mercy towards us? Did he look at our problem of sin and just say, you know what? Humans are humans. What are you going to do? The loving and merciful thing to do in that scenario would be, hey, stop. That you're not supposed to do that. And you get angry and you bring about justice because you understand that what's happening is unjust and it's not right. That's the loving and merciful thing to do. And that's what God has done. He says, look, I'm going to give you the remedy for your hard heart. I'm going to give you the thing you need to draw near to me. But if you reject that, if you don't want that, if you say no thank you, then love demands justice. And justice demands judgment. Now, some of us read this and we think, oh no, I sin intentionally sometimes. Is this the fate that awaits me? And I want to comfort you this morning. Say, if you're here this morning and you've thought that, this isn't you. Yes, we sin intentionally, and that's not okay. But go back to like Leviticus 6. If you sin intentionally, what do? You go and you present your guilt offering and you pay that restitution to say, hey, I understand that I wronged my brother. I understand that I did this with intention. And God is saying, give me your sacrifice and then give me the 1/5 compensation on top of that, the 20%. God in his mercy is saying, look, I don't want you to sin intentionally. Because when you start sinning intentionally and defiantly and you start rejecting me, this is what awaits you. Now, that might not be you, but it can be you. And that's why these verses are important for us to consider. But also for us to look at the greatness of our high priest. To say that we have a high priest who can be around our sin. He can be around our disease and he can fix it. And he can remove it from us. Just like God removed the sin of Isaiah through that burning coal when it touched his lips. That's what God can do for us. And that's what he has done for us. And so now, in a few moments, we're going to go into partaking of the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is a reminder of that great sacrifice, of that great covenant promise of that great high priest that says, draw near to me. And when you draw near to me, you bring others to draw near as well. And you keep bringing others with you. You don't stop doing that because you know the danger that awaits when you stop doing that. Questions or comments? All right. Tommy, you're in control. You can. Okay. Thank you so much for your attention. Thank you for your participation. Lord willing, on Wednesday, we'll discuss how the story of Leviticus fits into the entirety of the Bible. Y'all are dismissed.